Okay, so it's 10:15 now. I'm going to get started. Good morning, everybody. Everybody had a good night last night? Pretty much. If I lose my voice during the session, it's because I had a good night as well. My name is Jeremy Chapman. I am with the Office Product Group responsible for Office client deployment, packaging in both Click to Run as well as Windows installer packages. We're going to talk about Office 365 Pro Plus deployment using Click to Run and the different deployment options that you have for the new Office. If you think about Office today, there are two different installation types. The default one on every single SKU, whether it's consumer or anything Office 365, is Click to Run. The only way that you can get Windows installer packages today is if you have a volume license agreement. So whether you buy Home and Student at Home, whether you buy Office 365 Pro Plus, small business, premium, any of those will use a click-to-run based package. Now, from an MSI standpoint, we don't really have to cover anything new because all of that we did in the MSI world back from 2007 forward, where we had the Office customization tool, those types of things, is identical. We did as little as possible in terms of investing into more stuff for the MSI because the future for us is the click-to-run package type. Now, what the click-to-run package type is, essentially, is it's built on Application Virtualization 5 underpinnings. It's using, for Office 365 Pro Plus specifically, subscription-based activation. If you're using a home SKU or a retail SKU of Office, then you will have perpetual activation available there as well. So Office Professional, Home and Student, University, all these different other SKUs that you might buy. Those can work with perpetual activation or subscription. So a lot of people will think click to run must equal Office 365 or subscription. No, it's the normal way that we install every version of Office except for volume licensing additions. One valid point to make you aware of here is if I want to do a couple of higher end scenarios around how I deploy Office, remote desktop services is one. And Windows to Go or shared computers, those need to use volume licensing bits. The reason why is that's basically a hardware-based install, and that's something that, from an RDS, remote desktop services perspective, you have to have the right keys and the volume licensing bits essentially for it to even install and then to run on those servers with that role enabled. For Windows to Go, the problem with a subscription-based activation is that every time I would take that stick and move it from machine to machine, it's going to basically have a different MAC address, different components that activation's looking for on the machine. With Windows to Go, we only bind to the hard drive. We don't bind to the rest of the hardware stack in terms of the activation. So if you use that Windows to Go stick, you would have to use volume licensing again. And it won't have to go to a KMS or any of those things every time you move it from machine to machine. Because again, the difference between volume activation and a retail-based activation or subscription activation is that volume activation only binds to that thumb drive in that case that's running on Windows to Go. Another thing that we'll hear a lot is shared computer scenarios. So we had a hospital, for example, in California, and they had 6,000 nurses, and they wanted to use Office 365. But they are going to change computers every single time they log in. So every day they might have 10 different sessions on 10 different computers. Now, I could line them all up on the Monday morning we deploy Office and have everyone assigned to one machine, and that works. Every profile that logs in is okay to run it. Problem is some of those nurses will leave the company, some will join, and as they do that, it's very difficult to manage, you know, which machines would belong to which person. So in those cases, instead of having the heartache of trying to manage the activations across, in that case, 6,000 machines and 6,000 users that change the machine every day, you would use volume licensing there as well. In terms of making that a hardware-based install that is often logged into by multiple people. With Click to Run, we have now the ability that it's in Office 365 in general to install on a physical or a virtual machine. In terms of the product use rights that you see in volume licensing, those allow for virtual machines for the first time as of January this year. And also, if you do have Office 365, you can get the access and the rights to volume license packages for RDS installations. So if you have Citrix ZenApp, for example, or using RDS, you can actually get rights to use the volume licensing packages that you need for RDS. The same is true for Windows to Go. So in the cases where you do have some virtualization running, and you do want to use Office 365 Pro Plus, and you need the volume license packages for those two architectures, then you'll be able to get them as part of normal exceptions inside of the product use rights in the volume licensing agreement. So in terms of click to run, if you've dealt with App V 4.6, anybody use App V 4.6? A couple people? Three? Four? In the old days of App V, and I say old days meaning anything pre-5.0, what would happen is you'd download the first segment of the application, the first block, and then you'd get 95% or so of the second block, feature block of that app. And once it was installed, it was isolated from other executables. Now, in the XP days, where you had something that we affectionately called DLL hell, we would like to have isolation from the other executables. But Office needs to have extensibility. It needs to be able to talk to add-ins, other configurations, the registry, the settings in the user account, and other exes, COM objects, whatever, on the machine. Now, with the new Click to Run and also App V version 5, you have the integrated option, which basically means it can behave like a normal set of applications. The features also, instead of being feature block 1 and 2, are loaded on demand. Office is actually based on about 1,900 components, and I'll go through the setup and how that works in a second. But basically, we are able to load those components. We can tell which ones will be needed first, and if a user is inside of an application like PowerPoint or Excel, we can apply most of our streaming and our functionality to that application, so that those features highlight or get provisioned first, and they'll come down in order of usage as we predict that you'll use them. But in cases where you want to use something, maybe you're in Word and you want to use a feature that's usually used at the very end, maybe of Word, like mail merge or something like that, it will actually take and reprioritize the queue of which features get loaded. So I will be able to load the features on demand. As I mentioned, once it's all done, it integrates with local executables, so it's not isolated like it would have been if you deployed with App V 4.6 and Office 2010, for example. And the other good thing that we get from App V as an application virtualization set of underpinnings is the ability to run side by side with previous versions of Office. Now, you could do this in the MSI, but what would the MSI do? It would uninstall the old version of Outlook, and every time you open one version or the other, they would try to run repairs on themselves to win back default file associations. With Click to Run, we accommodate for that, and basically we can run side by side with the older version. The older versions have been patched, 2007 and 2010, to where they don't fight for default file associations every time you open one suite or the other. So when I think of Office 365 Pro Plus, and this is just a high-level view of all this stuff, and we'll go deeper into details in a second, side-by-side installs, the other main benefit that you get for it is you get 5 installs per user on PCs or Macs. So anywhere you go, you can have 5 installs running at any given time. If I have 10 machines, I can deactivate one and reactivate the 6th or the 7th also on demand. And this spans across both PC and Mac platforms. So pretty cool stuff. Also, in terms of what you get from Office 365 that I won't talk about today, is the fact that we're roaming settings, links to most recently used documents that might be in SharePoint Online or SkyDrive Pro, being able to access those from any device as long as I can validate the path to that link and be able to access that file, which is an important point, because if I have users out at home installing Office provided by my company to that user, I may not want that home machine to be able to connect to my SharePoint assets. So in that case, I can lock the ability just to domain join machines if I want to have access to those files. If he installs Office on a home computer, it doesn't mean he has default access to everything in SharePoint that my company owns. He's not actually roaming the file itself, it's roaming the links to the files, and he has to be able to validate that path to access and download that file or view that file. We also work with automated software distribution. So if you have System Center Configuration Manager, Windows Intune, third parties, anything that will run an elevated command prompt to install software, like most things that distribute software do, is able to install Office. So whether it's Click to Run or the MSI, I can use System Center Configuration Manager, I can use Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, all of that stuff. plus all the group policy settings the same. Literally the ADMX files are identical between Office Professional Plus 2013 and Office 365 Pro Plus. So there's a lot of familiarity there, and there's a little bit of difference, but most of the stuff is shared in terms of how you would manage the configuration after Office is deployed. But what you get out of it is the ability to run side by side with older versions in a better way, more installs per user, the roaming settings, all of that stuff, plus you can have the control in terms of how you deploy and update Office. We'll talk about that a bit deeper as we go into the deck. So my two primary deployment options are, a user can self-install, which works for an unmanaged machine. Let's say you don't have an agent on that computer managing it, so it doesn't have CCM exec running from System Center or something like that. He can log in from home, and the experience that he'll see essentially looks like this. I'll just go to my demo machine here. When I go into my account, I log in, and you'll go to basically Office 365 settings just to navigate there in the software. And then you will see which computers are already deployed or installed with Office. So, for example, here I have it on a Windows 8 machine, my X220, and I can activate or deactivate that. Now, if I want to deactivate that, or say my admin deprovisions my account, if that's a privately owned machine, that activation of Office goes deactivated, so he cannot use it. He can only view documents with it, not edit them, not create new documents. So that means that, again, you've got the power, assuming that those assets belong to your company and you want to let people access Office from their home computers, their personally owned or privately owned computers, or you're doing bring your own device or any of that stuff, you have the ability to deprovision his Office installs that belong to you. Now, from an installation standpoint, user would just click on install after they select what language they want, 32 or 64-bit, pretty standard stuff. And then at that point, it will stream from the web onto that computer, onto their home or personally owned device. Now, if you do have users running as local admins on domain joined machines, which we never recommend, you could also do this in an enterprise environment. But in most cases, you're going to want to do option B on our slide, which is basically going to be deployed from an on-premises location. So in this case, it's kind of like System Center is now with Office 2010. You download the bits, you import the bits into your config manager environment, you set up a package, and then you deploy that out, right? So it works basically in the same way. I can use both of these if I want to enable self-installation on, again, users that have home PCs that want to install Office. And on domain joined environments, I can use my deployment tools. I can use imaging tools as well if I want to use Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. If I want to bake it into a Windows imaging file, WIM file, I can sysprep Office after it's been installed. You want to do that before you activate it. And then that will be deployed through normal imaging as well. So all of these work. Even though we're streaming Office, we don't need internet connectivity to do that. We just need connectivity to where the file source is and be able to download those files. So let me show you what this all looks like running on my demo machine again. There's a question, yes? The streamed Office versions, we'll get to that, but Office 365 Pro Plus, anything click to run, anything Office 2013 needs Windows 7 or Windows 8 as a base OS environment. All versions, whether retail or volume licensing, virtual or physical, it's all Windows 7 underneath or higher, which I will deploy to now just to make the point. A lot of people think also that you need to have the newest version of Windows to deploy Office, which you don't. It works on Windows 7. We'll show that in a second. All right. So just to show one install of click to run, let me just full screen this. So if you go into the click to run, I just clicked on that, and hopefully it took my double click there. I want to show the actual processes running. Hopefully. There we go. Come back. Let me make sure that kicked off. Okay, I'll do it this way. Okay. So we'll show you how all the stuff works under the covers, essentially, in terms of the click-to-run install. And I'll talk about that when I do anatomy of the actual setup process itself. So now I've started the integrated Office process. Now, one thing to note here is that it's under the user account that initiated the process. It's in session 1 right now, not in session 0. As I go further on into the setup process, I've got another integrated Office that opens that's under the system account in session 0. Basically, what we're doing in the first account is setting up the virtual file system, and then we're going to pass that off into a service that's running the rest of the streaming. Why are we doing this? If, say, for example, the user stops, logs off of his machine, you know, severs his connection to the install source, whether it's the internet or your local network, whatever, we can resume where we left off because it's a service at that point. The user doesn't have to be an administrator on the box either, as long as, again, I'm initiating that through, like I would normally do, CCM exec or whatever agent I have on that machine. Then everything can run through session 0 as the initiator and the actual streaming and caching agent. Once that's starting to cache, even before it's loaded, I will see that I have Office available to me in my start menu, and I can launch it even before it's fully cached. You see that Office is still streaming in the background. And one question I get a lot is, okay, well, I can launch an app pretty quickly using click-to-run, you know, because everything's not fully cached on the local disk yet. But does the entire package actually install faster than if I was to use an MSI? So if I have an MSI, at RTM, the day that we ship it, usually it's about a 7 or 8 minute install. Add a service pack to that, maybe 2 in the updates folder, add the updates after that, and your install can quickly become 30 or 60 minutes because you layer on service packs, updates, all those things in the MSI-based package. With click-to-run, everything is cumulative. It's like a SP1 slipstreamed version of Windows where I've got everything built into that image file. So regardless of where I'm at in the life cycle of the product, the install is going to be about 2 minutes before it's usable, and as you see here, less than 4 minutes in this case before it's fully cached. If I was connected to the internet, if I was connected to a local distribution point, which I am in this case, I have, as you can see, no internet access on this computer. It's all coming from the local file shares. Then basically, I'm able to take this offline, go into an airplane, go into a cave, nuclear submarine, wherever I need to go. At that point, I can run offline for 30 days in Office 365 Pro Plus after I've activated it. So I've got 30 days to be completely off the network. Now, if I come back on the network, let's say I've got 6 weeks of vacation. I used to live in Germany and take 6 weeks in one block. And I come back to the office after 6 weeks, feeling refreshed. I open my desktop, and I would basically not have to do anything because I would connect to the internet, it would go and rearm the activation, and I would just be able to launch Office as usual, even though technically it's deactivated. If I did the same thing and had no internet connection, I would see Office hasn't connected to the licensing service for more than 30 days. We have put you in a reduced functionality mode. Connect to the internet. At that point, you connect to the internet, and it reactivates, it rearms. But as you can see here, I'm able to install it completely offline using, if I want to, scripts or in this case, I used a link on the desktop. Now, integratedoffice.exe is the process that will continue to run. And one of the things that you also see here is this video and this first run experience. That's firstrun.exe. If you want to, you can actually kill that exe on setup, as you'll see in a second. I've done that in my demo environment. Or you can also get rid of all the prompts, which we'll talk about in terms of silent installation in a bit. So let me just compare that install to a Office 2010 Service Pack 1 install, just to show what the differences are in speed. So I'm going to move this off to the side a little bit, and then I'm going to kick off this install, and then I'm going to race this install, as I like to do, against 13 installs of click-to-run. We'll hit install now. Now we'll erase our MSI package. Again, all of these machines aren't connected to the internet. This is just a standard installation script on each machine, but I could be using System Center. I could be using, you know, OpenView, Tivoli, whatever I've got in terms of software distribution. So as you can see, I've got a bunch of desktops here as well. They're all running various flavors of Office. So Office 2003, and we'll go ahead and open a sample file, because not only can I have Office installed on these computers, but workers can actually still be using their email, working, doing whatever they need to do while you provision the new packages. So we'll go ahead and open the same file in Office 2007 and the same file in Office 2010. So I've got a couple of installs that have already, these are already usable, these two. I've got a couple that have kicked off. And here is Word 2010 with the same file. Again, all these files open. And just to make sure I'm honest, I will open the Start menu and show that, well, it might actually pop up while I open the Start menu, but show that the new Office isn't installed. It's just the 2010 set of Office apps. So basically, let's see how our MSI is doing. We'll have that visible. The progress bar says 50%, but as you and I both know, once it gets to the end of the progress bar, it's going to have to install Service Pack 1 in about 75 updates. So it's not even close to half, and we are just about ready on all of these other computers to use Office in about 2 to 3 minutes. So part of my installation script will change the background, killsfirstrun.exe. As you see up here, and I have now Office 2003 alongside the new Office 365 Pro Plus. I'll go ahead and show that running side by side with the new version and the old version of Word. And even though Office is at about 15% here, I can launch Word already and start using it. Here's my old Word next to the new Word. And I've got both versions running side by side. Now, the nice thing with this is that if I'm concerned about things like add-ins, macros, if I'm concerned about files, let's say it's the end of my fiscal year and my finance department really needs to be able to use Excel. In these cases, they can do that. They can go back to the older version if they need to. You don't want to have this as a perpetual configuration. You don't want to have always two versions of any app on a machine, but during the transition, as you're going from an older version of Office to a newer one, you can keep the two versions side by side. As eventually the users start to use the newer products, we take over default file associations. Hopefully they get comfortable with the user interface, which is, you know, whiter, a little bit different looking than the older one, depending on if you're coming from 2003 or 7 and above. But this gives them time to actually get used to the new apps. It gives you time to test if you're doing testing. So the users who use the actual spreadsheets and those things can actually test those files and have a way to go back to the older version if they detect something that doesn't work. By default, we try to make sure that everything just works, whether it's the file types, even if it's the old proprietary doc or XLS pre-OpenXML, those will all continue to work. So now I have the ability to run side by side, the old Office with the new Office, and basically have a safety net in case I need it. You'll see here our MSI is still chugging along, and it still looks like it's at 50%. In this window. So just to show a comparison in terms of the speed of the two different installation types, but that's kind of what we're doing here in terms of making the installation itself much faster and building it in a way that won't get slower over time as you get more and more updates that you have to put into the Office package, because they are part of a cumulative updated image that gets revved every patch Tuesday. So how does this all work? Well, basically, as I mentioned when we watched kind of the different processes under setup, in the first 10%, the initiator of the process, whether it's the user, whether it's your software distribution agent, whatever you've got that initiates the process, that will run the first 10%, create the virtual file system. The virtual file system is a very fancy word for basically a folder that's in the program files destination that has all of the Office files in it. It basically will sandbox Office to one location. So normally when you install Office via Windows Installer package, I have stuff in common files, shared files across Windows. I have things in all different types of locations. So I'd inevitably have a competing DLL situation if I've got two versions of Office that are installing and writing DLLs to those same folders. In the virtual file system case, everything stays contained in the program files x86 folder. If it's program files x64 folder in both cases, if it's 32 or 64 bit, it will keep itself in that directory. Yes?
Can you
do I need the AppV agent for this? No, it's all integrated as part of the setup process. So optionally, I can use AppV, and we'll get to that. But I can just use native click to run, and it will set up the virtual file system and do all of that. In the AppV case, we're basically flattening the package, removing the stuff that would set up the virtual file system, because the AppV agent does that anyway. So and we'll see a demo of how you sequence Office for AppV in a second. So after the initiator process builds the virtual file system, it then turns it into a service, streaming begins, and starts caching Office into the local directories at about 10% in the progress window. As you've seen, the percentages fly by. You can launch applications fairly solidly at about 15%. You don't want to go any earlier than 15%, but that's about when you would launch the apps. And it will tell you in the white window, here's Office, welcome to it. Now you can actually start using your apps. One inside story to that, if you ever watch the little video that has the car driving and the guy signing into Office and all that stuff, I know IT pros love this. I used to when I was an IT pro. That's actually something to buy time to get more Office cached as they watch the little video, so they can get maybe 30% of it streamed before they try to launch the app. After we're fully cached, it's usually about 3 to 5 minutes, depending on how fast your network connection is. If you're on a really slow network, obviously it's going to be longer. But we tested about 6 megabit per second network speeds, and we're seeing usually somewhere in the 5 minute range to get Office fully cached. And once it's all done, at the final 10%, it installs SPP, which is the licensing and activation component. One fun fact there is that we actually do a temporary activation of Office while it's installing, and then at the very, very end of the install process, because SPP takes longer to install than the apps take to be able to use at first, we actually install at the very end of our bootstrapping process when we do Office. One other tangential side note to that is if you're using AppV and System Center or AppV natively to stream Office, you have to do it in cached mode and not in streaming mode, because that SPP bit needs to be available to Office essentially. So because of the way, if you think about Office in AppV 4.6, we had to deploy an MSI that would do activation and then deploy Office on top of that with streaming. Because in this case, SPP is at the end of the install process and we flatten that package, we have to use it in cache mode as opposed to in streaming mode. So this is the most exciting demo of the hour, the installation flat files. All right. What does this stuff all look like? Oops. So when I download Office, we'll go to the Office deployment tool in a second. I will get a folder structure that looks like, I'll go back to Office folder, and it has to be in this exact sequence of folders. This is what we'll give you default when you download it using the Office deployment tool, which we'll see in a sec. Data, and then we see the versions that we have. Now, these are important files. This one contains all of your Office package files. This v32.cab file, it's a cabinet file, as you can imagine. It contains the most recent build or the published build that you want to deploy to. Our setup process basically says, I'm going to mount that v32.cab file, and inside of that there's an identifier that says, in our case here, install 4481.1005 as the build number. Every time you download Office into this location, it's going to overwrite that v32.cab file. So every time a user hits this installation source, in this case, see Office deployment tool, it will mount that v32.cab file, and the newest one will win. Now, in this case, if I'm the IT guy who wants to run an older version of Office, I can basically overwrite that v32.cab with the older version I want, or I can actually stipulate which version or build of Office I want to install. So I've got full control. It doesn't have to take the newest build all the time or keep getting updates every month. Once I'm actually into the flat files themselves, I have a couple of things here to point out. We've got our cab files that are basically instructions as to how to build it. And then we have our language agnostic DAT file, which is equivalent to a Windows imaging file, a WIM file kind of. That contains all of Office plus Visio and Project. It's basically the Mondo build. It's everything that we have and every SKU of Office. The language packs, essentially, are these DAT files that have x86 ENUS or DEDE or ESES, all of those things. Those I would deploy with the package as well and stipulate which language I want in a configuration XML that I'll show you in a second. And that basically gives you the ability to customize on language, bitness architecture, all of those types of things that we'll go a bit deeper in. This DAT file, again, has every single SKU of Office. So it's basically dependent on the bootstrapper that I run against it. Whatever setup.exe I take and run against that DAT file, it's a single source of truth, and I can install every retail home SKU all the way up to Office 365 Pro Plus as long as I know what to pipe into that configuration file. By default, if I install from the internet, you'll see a really, really long .exe name that has the name of the product, a long GUID, where it's downloaded from, your licensing state, the architecture, all of that. That's basically a configuration XML file in the file name of that .exe that's instructing it what to download and install. So that leads me to the Office deployment tool. And this is basically something that you can get, anybody can get for free on the internet. It's on the Microsoft Download Center. It allows you to download, install, and sequence Office for App V. So there are kind of three main files that go with it: the setup, the configuration XML, the EULA, in terms of end user licensing agreement. And you have very simple command line steps that you'd use to run it. Now again, this is for IT admins, so this is something that, as I would have done when I was doing SCCM configuration management and all of those things, I might learn it one time, build the package, and forget about it. But this is all command line. There's not a user interface. The user interface, if you want to install with, you know, an install button, is the web, is logging into office.com and using your Office 365 creds. In this case, we use this command line tool to do either download the bits, configure, which is install or remove Office, and then the packager command will sequence Office for App V. Another question? It is, it will not do any volume license SKUs, but it will do Office 2013 perpetual retail SKUs, for example, or Office 365 Pro Plus in an enterprise environment. So we had the case, and this is recent, let's say in third world countries where they don't want to stream Office because it's a gigabyte payload, as you saw in those DAT and the language files. They might not want to have a card in an empty box with no media in it, so the retailer will put Office retail bits on that machine using this tool, basically with the config XML that says put home and student or pro or home and business or whatever on that box. So it does work in 2013 as well as Office 365 Pro Plus, as long as it's a click-to-run based package. And going back to the first slide, anything that's MSI is always volume licensing, so you don't use this to do anything with the MSI at all. The config XML that we'll show in a second, and then the syntax for the tool itself. Setup.exe, normal stuff, the mode, that's the download or configure or packager command, and the location of the XML. When you do a download, these are important. So where the setup.exe is, by default, if I don't stipulate where I want it to install from or download to, it will just go to the folder where setup.exe is located. In our case, if we set the server1/office/config/XML path, that's where it's going to download to. So let's say I'm running an update server that just by default has a scheduled task that every 15 days goes to the CDN, tries to download the newest Office build. I can do that and have it download to another location if I want. Right? So anytime I've got a location, that's where it's downloading to. Whereas if I do a configure and install, that location is where I install from. Right? Same path, same syntax, except download means it goes there, install means it comes from there. So that's how I'm doing the installs without being connected to the internet on this other machine. So the XML itself looks something like this. We have a source path. If we want to leave the source path completely out, which is what you would do probably in enterprise software distribution cases, it will look where the setup.exe is located by default. And if that doesn't resolve and find an Office folder with installation files in it, it will go to the internet if there's internet connectivity. In cases where there's not, if you're doing imaging or if you're doing something that's offline, you have to have a path that will resolve if it's not sitting next to that setup.exe, like it was in my case. So you have to give it a valid path. It can be a UNC path, it can be an HTTP path, all of those work. The client edition, 32 or 64-bit, question I get a lot, are you still default 32-bit and recommending that as the default option to install Office? Yes, because add-ins aren't all natively compiled for 64-bit. We're still kind of in the, I came from Windows, but we're still kind of in that phase where not everybody's snapped to a 64-bit environment from a ISV and add-in perspective. In terms of the product ID, yes, question? You can add third-party, so the question was, can you add third-party add-ins? You can add third-party add-ins like you would on the MSI, where you basically layer them in after the install. I can't kind of inject them into the image like I would have in Windows, for example, but I can add them and layer them on just like I would in the MSI world. Yes, you can. If you're using AppV, you can do connection groups and sequence the add-ins and define the connection groups as well. So there's a couple of options there. I can stipulate the language ID, so as long as I can get to the language DAT file that we saw earlier, ENUS, I could do DEDE, ESES, JAJP, all of those things. They just have to have the corresponding language file inside of that folder. Now, if you're running multiple languages, as most of you probably are in Europe, you'd have to have a separate command line with a separate configuration file to determine which language gets installed. So you probably do something that checks for the shell of Windows or does something in a group or a collection in System Center. Based on that or based on Windows default language, we would then pipe the correct command line with the correct configuration XML for that language. So you'd probably have, instead of install.xml, it would be install enus.xml and install dede.xml, and all of your packages will correspond with the languages that you want to install. That way you can automate language selection and have it match the computer that you're deploying to. We're going to talk about updates in a bit, but the updates enabled true and the updates path. This means you have control over the updates. I can turn it to false, and the update engine in Click2Run doesn't ever run. By default, the update engine runs 3 times when I log into the machine, and it runs at 3 o'clock in the morning, roughly every other night, and it will look at the update path that I stipulate. If I stipulate no update path, it will look to the internet, to the CDN, and it will give you the most up-to-date builds. In this case, if I want to run maybe a 1 or 2 or 3 month old build, I can set my update path, and everything I write to that v32.cab file, that's going to be the truth as to what build needs to be updated to. And I can use an HTTP path or a UNC path, but the main point is I have the ability to control which updates get loaded on that computer once I install this, assuming that I've configured the update path true, and that engine then will look at my location as opposed to the cloud to Office 365 for updates. I can kill the display level if I want to do completely promptless install, and I'll show you some more group policy settings that you'll need for that in a second. And I can tell where I want the log to be sent to as well. I'm not going to go through all of these different controls. They're in the deck if you want to download that after the session. But basically, the controls to download, you have add as kind of your parent command, product, the source path where you download to, the client edition, the language, and the version. For the install commands, some of the same ones, except, again, the source path is where you're installing from as opposed to where you're downloading to. And then more stuff that you can do. If you want to force a downgrade, so this will happen, let's say I've got auto-updating turned on. Somebody calls the help desk and says, hey, yesterday's build of Office worked just fine, but today's doesn't. What do I do? In that case, I send out a package that says, okay, let's downgrade him to yesterday's build. So in order to do that, I have to stipulate the force downgrade property, because otherwise it will look at the XML and say, I don't like everything in there. You're not giving me a newer build than the last one, so I'm going to force it to go down to an earlier build, and then it will apply that update. Another thing we can do if we have a critical security patch, force app shutdown is another property we can set to say, okay, I know there's a vulnerability I want to plug immediately. In that case, I set the force app shutdown, and then I run that package, and it will basically kill all of the Office processes for that user, install the patch, and then he will be up to date to the build that you want him to be on. In terms of the deployment tools, a lot of people are used to the Office customization tool. That's only in the MSI. We err on the side of configuration enforcement in terms of Click2Run. So we have the group policy controls as well as configuration.xml, but no Office customization tool. So that's a difference that you'll see in Click2Run versus the MSI. We don't have an OCT that does basically preference settings at install time. We do have group policy support for 2,200 controls that are the majority of what's in the OCT, but those will be enforced as group policy controls as opposed to just installation preferences that we would do with the MSI package. All right, let's do a quick demo of the Office deployment tool. And I'm just going to actually launch it and show you the controls of it because we already saw it working when we did our install. All right. So just running setup XE. You'll see we've got, as I mentioned, download, configure, packager. And we'll see, and I'll show what packager looks like running to Sequence Office. But those are the main things that you're running, as I mentioned. But this is what the tool looks like. It's purely a command line tool. So in terms of distributing updates for Office, and I mentioned some of this earlier in my talking points, but there are the options of automatically downloading from Office 365. We basically align with Patch Tuesday. All the documentation for the cumulative updates is aligned with the same things that we do on the MSI servicing side. So all of the support pages that say what's been updated, along with the corresponding build number, are published every month. If you don't want to use default updates because you want to test stuff before the updates get deployed, then you can set the engine to look, again, at your on-premises location. And if you don't want to do that and you want to just run System Center and have it basically turn off automatic updates in that engine altogether, you can rerun setup. Now, in all of these cases, what we're doing is comparing what's on the local disk against deltas that you're going to give it to with the newer package. And it will only apply the delta files as opposed to the entire payload of Office. So the scheduled tasks, as I mentioned, are running three times after I log in at 15, 45, and 75 minutes. Then we'll do a discovery to see if there's a newer package, mounting that v32.cab file, finding the package, compare the different packages. So we have about 1,900 different components that we compare against each other. We only then download and cache the ones that we need. At that point, we run the installation. So there's a kind of a three-step process: discovery, comparison, cache, and then install. And after that, you know, again, we can do all of these past three options, either automatic from on-premises or a managed web location, or rerun and setup, all use that same mechanism. That update location, as I showed earlier, was set in the XML file. So this is how you would set those properties from a config XML perspective. Updates enabled, true, that means that your engine is turned on. Update path, if it's blank like we have here, that's going to go to the web. Once I define an update path as my server or an HTTP path, that's going to go to wherever I want it to go to look for updates. And if I do it false, that means that I have to push another package to it later with a newer build of Office once I want to package it. I can have up to 1 year of difference in terms of the time of the most up-to-date build in the cloud in the Office 365 content delivery network and what I deploy. So I've got a year to deploy that update. Same thing is true, and this is a question I get a lot. What happens when I get to the next version of Office, version 16? Do I have to take that the day it ships? No. You have 1 year to test it and validate it and train your users, all that stuff. At that point, you have to deploy 1 year after, like any other update, after that version ships. So you always have this 1 year window that you can drift out of the most recent build of Office if you want to using Office 365 Pro Plus. Yes? The question is, can users use 2010 today if they've got access to Office 365 Pro Plus, the newer version? No, there's not default access. What we did do is we grandfathered all of the Office 365 previous tenants in Wave 14, so they have access to both packages, but anybody who signed up after February 29th this year only has access to Office 365 Pro Plus. They can't use the 2010 packages by default in that case. They won't see them. So. Managed deployments for Office 365 Pro Plus. So the common deployment types, you can use a network share, group policy, startup script, all of those things like you could do in the MSI in 2010. You can use application virtualization at V5. You have to use the most recent version of System Center Configuration Manager, which supports the at V5 underpinnings. Windows Intune will work. Microsoft Deployment Toolkit will work. If I'm using imaging, I can basically install Office in a pre-activated state, sysprep that, and image it, and distribute that across all the machines that I want to. And I can use it in user-dedicated virtual desktops, which, again, as of this release, is new that we can apply it to virtual machines. It was completely blanket, not covered in terms of support in earlier Wave 14 in terms of how you can deploy Office 365. So if you do have somebody offshore dev or somebody that's logging into a remote machine, or you have VDI configured so that it is a static desktop per user, those will work because it will just connect to the internet, keep activated, and the user is assigned to that one virtual image, so it will just work just like a normal physical desktop would. So that has changed recently. So for the cases of RDS, shared virtual desktops, Windows to go, pooled VDI, some of the higher end VDI scenarios that I might do in terms of session based, dynamic, you know, when I'm actually putting together the application layer, the Windows layer, and the user state layer, those types of configurations are going to need volume license packages to be able to use the new Office. So for RDS and Windows to go, you have the exception to get those through licensing, so that you can have those if you use them now with Office 365 Pro Plus rights. But for the other scenarios, other virtualization options, et cetera, you have to buy a virtual volume license package of Office. Yes, question? Again, RDS, it has to be using a volume license you'd even install, because the setup bootstrapper will detect that RDS is enabled, and it will actually kick off, or it will kick an error message to the user when I install. So I have to have a volume license package to even succeed. And then runtime, we look to see whether there's RDS role on that server enabled, and then we'll stop the apps from booting. So that you have to use the volume license package right now. That's correct. So that's, as I mentioned, you use Office 365 Pro Plus. The exception gives you the rights to the volume license packages for those users that are covered with the license. And that way, if you have RDS or Citrix NAP or one of those types of options, you can use that in this case. Basically, you get the volume license bits by subscribing to Office 365 for those architecture types. So. Using AppV to deploy Office. So. This is going to be good news for people that have packaged Office in the past. Sometimes it might take you weeks, months, days, if you're good, to package or sequence Office 2010, for example, with AppV 4.6. In this case, because we're based on AppV, we just have to run a single command line with our packager tool, or with our Office deployment tool, the packager command, and it will basically sequence Office in about 4 minutes with one command line. And it's a perfectly sequenced package. It's parity with a normal install of click to run, retail install, or whatever. I have the option later, if I want to, say, make it an isolated application and have it completely isolated from all the exes on the box, or I can keep it integrated, which is the default scenario where it will be able to read my add-ins, my user customizations, all of that stuff, and install just like a native click-to-run package does. So what that looks like, and hopefully if you've sequenced Office, this will be welcome news to you. All you have to do is run your Office deployment tool with the packager command. You're going to need to point to your XML file that will dictate which bitness and architecture that you want to load, and then say where you want to store those AppV files. At that point, basically what happens is it runs a command called flattener.exe that goes and changes that package for AppV use. Again, as mentioned earlier with the question, it's taking out all of the stuff in the setup.exe that's adding the virtual file system and all of those components to run the application, creating your manifest file to how it behaves, and all of the .appv files that you need to deploy Office. Again, that payload is about a gigabyte, because we're taking the entire package, we're converting it, and we have our language-specific files as well. But that, and this is a language-specific appv package in that case, but that gets curated automatically through that packager command. So when you're using Configuration Manager to deploy, and this is where things get a little bit tricky, I've got an application model and a package mode. Now with application model, as some of you know, when I deploy an app, it always caches everything in the CCM cache. So if I want to deploy that way, what will happen is it will try to download the whole payload of 1 gigabyte every month I want to apply an update. However, if I use package mode or if I point the update engine to somewhere else, I can basically just do the deltas. So in that case, I don't advise you use the package model in terms of System Center Configuration Model Manager because it will download that entire 1 gigabyte payload every month into CCM cache. I would rather have you go to a v32.cab location that you manage, and then it will just pull down the delta files. The largest set of delta files we've seen is around 300 megabytes compressed. Typically, though, it's around 50 megabytes or so per month as we update Office. So it's a fairly small package, kind of similar to the MSP files in aggregate that we'd have each month. In terms of what you can use ZAPV5 only, not any 4.6. And you need to use that, as I mentioned earlier, you want to download and execute to use the cache mode as opposed to streaming mode from an activation perspective to run ZAPV with Office. So if I'm using System Center Configuration Manager to deploy Office 365 Pro Plus and not doing ZAPV, this is what that process looks like, and it's just like pretty much any software package that runs in XE. So I give that a name, browse to where my files are. This is a normal standard program. It's going to run, you know, a normal context. I can have it be a required program, or I can have it show up in Software Center, however I want to do that. We will run setup.exe with a configure switch and then point to our install.xml file, which in the SECM case, it will know that it's next to setup.exe. I have to have a full path in terms of the configuration file. Once that's been in there, I can actually run deployment against that and deploy the package out as I normally would with software in System Center. Add it to my DP. I can make it required. If it's available, that means the user can see it in Software Center and elect to install it if he wants, which we'll do in this particular case. And now it's basically ready to be installed by the user. You see the package size, 996 megabyte, and there's an install of that now, but we can see the user experience. In this case, it's not a required package, so I've set it up to have the user select to install it. I could have done it required or have users select to install it. It will then cache everything into the TCM cache folder, and at that point, it will install Office. So it's just like any other installation of Office in that sense, but after I'm done caching the package, the installation obviously is much faster than it would have been with the MSI package of Office. So in about a minute, I will see all my icons show up in my start screen, and I'll be able to launch and execute Office if the user did elect in that case to self-install. And there you have it. In terms of MDT, so this is a product that I'm very near and dear to in the team that developed this from the kind of early days of business desktop deployment. It's the same type of thing. The thing that's a bit different here, MDT runs by the initiator of the process. So the system account that runs the streaming service, the caching needs to have the rights to access the path of where those files are. What we'll often see in an MDT-based install is that the users might have access to the distribution point or the deployment share, but the system account won't have access to the deployment share when it comes online. In that case, what you can do is, as I do, copy into the deploy root applications folder where I want to have the app. That will put it locally on the computer. Then I can install Office 365 Pro Plus from local source, which will be okay with from a user initiator account or the system account. So what that looks like here, two tasks that I added to MDT, the MDT task sequence, an xcopy command, and then an install from that location. Nice thing about putting it in the deploy root in that folder is that when I'm done deploying, it will automatically delete those files from that deploy root folder. So what that looks like then in terms of the installation running in MDT, so just to show what deployment workbench would be, in this case, our task sequence properties. I've got my copy command to copy it to a local disk, and then my install command to install from that copy. And I run my MDT task sequence as I normally would. And basically, I'll be able to install Windows and install Office in the same way that I would normally install those two if it was an MSI, except in our case here, we've had to optimize, for permission's sake, where those files are. So here we have our integrated Office processes, and because maybe the system account doesn't have access to our deployment share, it might or it might not, depends on how you set up your directory policies. But at that point, it's here in our case, it's installing from a local source, so the system account does have access to it because it's on the C drive of the computer. Then I'll see that Office gets installed, as you can imagine. Here's what the folder structure looks like. Virtual file system is there. The apps are actually in that VFS folder. And I can launch while it's installing Office and have that normal experience. One thing you'll notice here is that setup.exe doesn't exit until it's fully cached. So if I'm running an automated installation, silent install of Office, in the early days of beta, we would exit setup process, for example, right after it was able to be launched, in about the 10% mark. The problem with that is if I'm in MDT, for example, and I've got my source somewhere on the C drive and I stop, I basically turn off the machine after the deployment task sequence is completed, I may not have finished caching everything, and LightTouch cleanup.wsf, the script that cleans up the deployment share, would then delete source possibly before it's fully cached. So we made a change to setup to say wait till it's fully cached and then exit the setup process. So this will stay running in the task sequence because it's waiting for that process to exit until it's fully cached. Another thing that you can do now, which is pretty exciting, is actually leverage the cloud to deploy as a deployment point. So instead of using on-premises file share or deployment share, you can actually stipulate in your source path to go to the cloud, even if you're doing a SCCM or a Windows Intune deployment. So the nice thing about that is I can use the pipe of the internet from that user's machine. Let's say he's on Intune, which means he's connected to the internet by default anyway. And I can use, instead of using my VPN small straw of a pipe, I can use his normal internet pipe. I can stipulate the version I want, the language, the architecture, all the stuff in the config XML file, and have it come from the internet and the cloud CDN, the content delivery network from Office 365, and leverage that as opposed to having to have it go through my VPN pipe. But I still have full control. So if I'm using Config Manager, I can accomplish things like this with Windows Azure distribution points. If I'm using Windows Intune, then I can just couple that with Office 365. I can also couple Config Manager with Office 365 or even MDT. It just depends on where that source path is looking for the files and for the bits. Question? Can I use branch cache as a directory? Yes, because basically it would have to validate through the branch cache service where those paths are, so it would be able to read that if you've got branch cache turned on. Because it's doing the same thing it does if it's looking for any file in a file share that has branch cache applied to it. So, good question. Traditional software deployment, normally I download bits from the VLSC, put it into local source, upload it into Windows Intune, and then after that I can push it out. In the case of Office 365 Pro Plus, instead of doing those extra steps, I can basically set my configuration options, use the Office deployment tool, which is a tiny package, about half a megabyte or less, push that out, which is basically an instruction set to the client, and then it will go and stream from Office 365's cloud as opposed to my Windows Intune storage. And I still have full control over what gets installed because I can't modify those DAT files anyway. So every time Intune installs, it's going to look at what I tell it to install and how I want it to update and all of those things. I've got complete control in that case. So the process there just basically looks like this. I configure the installation controls, make sure the apps are available to users to self-install or make it a required package, stream the apps from the Office cloud in that case, and then the success will be reported back to Intune after setup exits, just like a normal install. So what that looks like running is basically if I'm in my Intune console, I can go into my software node and add software to that, kind of like I do at System Center. It's about the same process. In our case, we'll add the Office 365 Pro Plus package. We'll edit the properties here, just so you can see what's in there. And there, it's similar to what we had in terms of the System Center environment, publisher, and normal stuff, description, and system requirements. Here, we can set them to, say, Windows 7 or newer. We can add a detection rule. In my case, I'm just looking for a path to validate for WinRAR.exe. You could look for folder validation. Configure command as we had in the previous one. In this case, I don't have to put setup there because it's already in the first step as to what it needs to run. Return code, zeros, we use normal return codes. And then we can save that and actually show what that looks like being deployed out to a user. So we'll manage a deployment. We'll basically set up who gets rights to the package and add the all users group, which you probably don't want to do in most deployments. Maybe sometimes you do, but not every time. And we'll finish that and then see what the user experience looks like. But you'll notice that the package size itself here is 461 kilobytes, less than half a meg, because that's all we need to do in terms of getting the instruction set down to the client. So now the client experience. He logs into his Windows Intune application selector. He'll see what's available to him. Now we've got Office 365 Pro Plus available to him and some other stuff I've put in there. And once he clicks on Office 365 Pro Plus, you can determine where that install happens. So even on other machines, you can install it, or in this case, he's going to put it on his Jeremy Intune box, which is the local machine. Once he clicks install, this is where it's kind of cool because I can use streaming again to get Office on the machine quite quickly. So when it says Windows Intune is downloading the software, all it needs to do is download that tiny XML file on that tiny setup.exe, the instruction set. It will install using streaming, so it's actually going to stream that from the Office 365 cloud. We'll see all of our applications populate very quickly like it would if I was installing it, you know, from the web directly. But in this case, Intune's managing the process. And once we're fully cached again, setup will exit, tell Intune that it was successful, and everything will run. So in other words, I get all the performance benefits I would get from streaming it from the Office 365 cloud. But in this case, Intune manages the entire process for me, whether user's admin or not, you know, whether it's his home machine and I want to stipulate the version and all the add-ins and other things I want to install on top of it. All of that I could do through Intune, but basically redirect Intune's call to the Office 365 cloud. That, again, all works inside of Config Manager, MDT, or anything else. It just depends on where you want that source to be loaded from. In terms of eliminating the prompts in a silent installation, there are a few steps that you have to do. I wish it was as easy as saying auto-activate equals true in the XML and, you know, do not show first run. But we want to disable first run experience, and I always love the group policy, enable the disable of the first run movie. If you don't want to see the awesome movie that's in the first run.exe, you can also disable first run altogether when a new user signs into Office. So what will happen on every single user profile is it will run that movie to try to train the next user on the machine how to use the new Office. If you want to disable that, you can use the control disable Office first run on application boot and enable that one. All of the kind of initial privacy settings in terms of do you want to opt into customer experience improvement program, the opt-in wizard for you know, feedback, all of that stuff, we can get rid of all of that through policy as well and disable Watson reports being sent back to Microsoft, all the stuff that you'd typically set in the MSI deployment to make it silent and have it never prompt the user for anything. The small updates, you probably want to disable that as well. And then this is an important one. If you've got Active Directory Federation services set up and you don't want the user to have to sign in to activate Office on first run, remember, we're associating every Office install with a user, and the user will see that in his install software portal, and he can activate or deactivate Office as he wishes. But if I want to use Windows Integrated Auth, I can set up ADFS, and I can set this block sign into Office, and only enable the org ID, and that will basically say, I can't sign into an Office 365 Home Premium or an Outlook.com type account for signing in. And if I want to get rid of the, if I want to block in signing into Office altogether at first run, this basically will pull in the Windows Integrated Authentication parameters, the creds of the domain creds of that user, and push those up to the authentication engine through ADFS and activate the product. So he doesn't see a sign-in experience. Because most people will say, well, I can just run KMS now, and it will blindly activate everybody as those Office installs come online. In this case, you can do that here as well. In some instances, you will see the user get prompted if he starts to click on things before Office is fully cached. Why? Because of what I mentioned earlier with SPP being installed at the very end of the install process. So once Office is fully cached, the 4 or 5 minutes later, after it's kicked off by a CCM exec or whatever, it will do the integrated authentication for you and sign in on behalf of the user and do all of that. But if he launches those apps in that 5 minute time window, which is not too likely, but not too terrible, because hopefully he has the same domain creds anyway, so he just logs in with his domain creds, and that will activate Office. If he goes earlier, then we can pull it through Windows Integrated Auth into the ADFS system. Any questions there? Yes. We still will pull in integrated auth, assuming it's a domain join machine, if he's logged into his profile and his session on that machine, because you've still got ADFS running in the background and it will broker all of that and still activate. If he's in the domain, it will run, or if he's outside in a private network, that will still work. I mean, worst case, sometimes he'll get a prompt to enter his user creds. It happens on occasion, but we've designed it to be promptless if you configure all this stuff. Okay, so we've got about 8 minutes left. I want to wrap up with one quick other demo. So I've been doing Garage Series shows on TechNet for the last 6 months or so. Anybody watch this stuff at all? No? I do a bunch of crazy things like install Office while jumping out of airplanes, aerobatics tricks. Last week we did real-time co-authoring of the blues band in New Orleans. So we did a bunch of stuff in terms of showing how Office works, all the IT controls, and try to make it as interesting as possible with a bunch of gimmicks to make it entertaining. So one of the things that people ask me is, will I be able to install Office 365 Pro Plus during free fall before I open my parachute? So because I got that question so many times, I decided to actually test it out. And here you go. So here's our licensed stuntman. His name actually is Foley Sick, legally.
You know the Australian Aviation Authority.
So this was done in Australia. My co-host of the show, Yoni Kirsch, is an Australian Office MVP.
Awesome, and you actually taped like a tablet.
And a Samsung tablet on his chest, and we kick off the install to see if he can get that running prior to opening the chute.
Working by the time he hits the ground.
Well, look, most of the instances we've seen were about...
They gave a little bit of a head start in the plane, but...
We had a usable version of Office that we could, say, click into work.
So now he's installing Office. It's hard to see it with the solar flare on that machine, but it is actually working, installing as he's descending to the Earth. And so we do stuff like this on our show. We do aerobatics. We do, we install in my car. I actually raced it across... I did an Intune install in my car, in the dashboard of my car, before I crossed a bridge to see if I could do it. All these things I like to do just to have fun with it. But in this case, he's not supposed to open his chute unless he knows the Office is running.
Wow, this guy looks like he's having a good time.
Yeah. Oh, look at his cheeks.
And there was another diver, skydiver, with two GoPros on his head and the wingsuit so he could modulate his speed to get the sky.
Do you think he's actually going to use it up in the air like this?
I don't know.
No. That would have been cool, though. I could have done that. That would have been a little bit of fun coding to do that. But yeah, it could have worked that way. So he did survive. We have a longer version of this if you want to watch it in our highlights reel for the season one episodes. For more information, this again, if you download the deck off of the TechEd site, Office Deployment Tool is linked from it. Check out the TechNet content roadmap for deploying Office 365 Pro Plus that covers all this and more. The Office IT Pro blog, which has all of the Garage Series stuff. We do 12 shows that go from everything from what is Office 365 all the way through to clever workarounds in cases where I can't do things, to virtualization scenarios, et cetera, throughout with all these stunts kind of as part of that, and then the Office IT Pro Tech Center. At TechEd this week, it's passed because we're at Friday, but there was an App V in Office Better Together session that I would encourage you to watch. There's an Office 365 deployment session, which is also very valuable because you have to do identity now to deploy Office to sign into it. And that will cover those aspects of getting identity running so that the sign-in will work. Hands-on labs, we have deploying Office as a service, and also my Garage Series videos, microsoft.com/garage. I blog about that. I do extensive, you know, all of the silent install commands I blogged about because I couldn't find them on TechNet. All of that stuff, we blog, you know, pretty deeply on the various topics that we cover. Ignite training, all of the labs that you see here are based on Ignite training. All the sessions that you'd ever want to watch from an Office 365 perspective, a lot of them I've done on the client side, a lot of them have been done on the identity side, Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, all that stuff is at ignite.office.com. There's a huge set of hands-on labs online that are hosted there, so that's also a cool resource if you want to know more. From a track perspective, a couple more things. But that is all I have today. I've got a couple, if you're interested, a couple of additional slides in the deck that kind of explain other things that are here, how to enable verbose logging. I blogged about that a little bit ago. Disabling first run experience, et cetera. All those things we've got in this deck as well if you want some more resources. So thanks for coming today. I've got about 3 minutes left. Appreciate it, and have a great rest of your week, one day here in Madrid. Thank you.